Welcome to Energy Law Roundup, your comprehensive weekly briefing on legal news and developments in the energy industry from Texas and across the country, always in 30 minutes or less. And now, your host for Energy Law Roundup, business litigator and oil and gas trial lawyer, Tom Charlone.
It is the week of July 30th, 2018. Again, my name is Tom Charlone. I'm a litigation partner in the Houston office of Kane Russell, Coleman & Logan, where I serve as the head of our firm's energy practice group. In this week's episode of the podcast, we're bringing you the final installment in a six-part series of presentations that our practice group recently made to the Association of Corporate Counsel here in Texas on a variety of key and emerging issues impacting the oil and gas industry. Chip Morris serves as a director in the Houston office of KRCL, where he specializes in intellectual property, with a special emphasis on trade secrets and agreements not to compete. Today, Chip will talk to us about the top 10 mistakes employers can make in the oil patch and beyond when drafting non-compete agreements. Whether it's recovering lost profits for the patent holder of one of the most successful infomercial products ever made, whether it's protecting the trade secrets of how to build the world's fastest streetcar, whether it's representing a major television network against a cyber squatter, Chip Morris has decades of experience successfully representing and advising clients on a wide range of intellectual property and employment litigation and counseling matters. Chip is the head of our firm's intellectual property practice, and he's the former chairman of the American Bar Association's Subcommittee on Trade Secrets and Tortious Interference with Contractual Relations. Chip has extensive experience in litigating trade secret and covenant not to compete cases, having been involved in over 50 successful trials, injunction hearings, and arbitration and contempt hearings. And he has authored successful briefs in two of the most significant appellate decisions in the area in the state of Texas. Chip, take it away.
So what I'm going to do is I'm going to talk to you about 10 mistakes that I typically see in non-compete agreements that when I get them, I'm thinking, okay, if we would have drafted them a little bit differently, we'd be in a much better position. The first one is, number 10 is, one-size agreement do not fit all. An agreement for a salesperson will not necessarily be enforceable against an engineer, which may not be enforceable against an executive, because the key to an enforceable non-compete is reasonableness of the restrictions. And different salespeople, executives, have different business interests that they're trying to protect. Number 9, having employees agree to no bond. I see those provisions all the time. The problem is it sounds like a good idea. Hey, I don't want to have to pay a bond if I can stop my employee, okay? Because sometimes those bonds are up to $10,000. Well, the problem is if you don't post a bond, the injunction you get is void, okay? Most people don't know that. Another mistake is no company assignment provision. Everybody's being bought and sold. Because a non-compete is a personal services agreement, if there's not an assignment provision that says the company may assign when they sell the company, guess what? That employment agreement may not be assignable, and that non-compete that you're paying millions and millions of dollars for all those employees is not enforceable. Number 7, another common mistake is choice of form clause, okay? Either they're not in there or you don't really think about it. So as everyone knows, there are certain jurisdictions you do not want to be in if you're a big company. So if you can take a step back and look at where your employees are, more importantly, where your main office is, you can draft choice of form clauses that may be more advantageous to you than if you just leave it up to either whatever I've always done or not have one at all. Number 6, having an agreement effective on signature date. When you have 100 employees or 1,000 employees, many times the company never signs the agreement. And so it's just because there's so much going on. And so if the agreement isn't effective till all signatures are on the agreement, that can be a real problem. If the employee never signs it, that's the biggest problem, because you're not going to have an enforceable agreement. But even if the company doesn't sign it until the signature date, which may be 3 or 4 or 5 or 2 days after they left, it's really hard to go into and get to the courtroom and get a TRO when they say, well, judge, they never signed this, or they signed this 2 weeks ago. So what you do is you don't have a signature date on my drafted non-competes. I don't have a signature. I don't have a date at all by the signatures. I have an effective date. And the reason you have an effective date is because you put that date either the first day that they showed up, when they got a promotion, you know, whatever date is most advantageous. And by doing that, you don't have to worry about, oh, I forgot to sign it, because it doesn't matter when you signed it. It's the effective date. The fifth one, and this isn't a drafting mistake, this is sign the agreement. It just makes it easier if you have an annual review of your employment agreements and just go through and make sure that there's signatures. Because if you do the effective date provision that I suggest, it doesn't matter when you sign it, but it's just always better to sign it before the employee leaves. Better optics. Another problem I see is when I'm going down to get a TRO or a temporary injunction hearing is we have all these lists of what a trade secret and all the confidential information we're trying to stop. The problem is technology changes. And some of these agreements that have been written 10, 15 years ago hasn't the definition of trade secret hasn't, or confidential information, has not kept up with the technology or actually what your company does. So go ahead and look at what trade secrets or confidential information is in that provision and then update it. And what I've done for you is over the years, every time I have a trade secret case or I see these agreements, I put, here's a type of trade secret, okay? And in the materials, you actually have a checklist of probably every single piece of confidential information you ever wanted to see. But it's very good and very useful when you're drafting these agreements, because you may say, oh, I didn't think of this or I didn't think of that. So that's for your use. Number three is including specialized training programs. Because of the old case back in 1994, it's WLite Centel Cellular. Everybody thought you had to have specialized training as a business interest to have enforceable non-competes in Texas. That's not the case anymore. And in fact, it's almost impossible to prove that your employee or numbers of your employees got such specialized training that it's a valid business interest, okay? So when you have that provision in there, you're bringing in an obligation onto the company that is not necessary. And when you're trying to get a TRO, the last thing you want to do is, when you're going down as a company, is you want the fewest number of obligations that the company has to do and the most on the former employee. The second most common is having a non-solicitation provision only. There's a new case that came out in the 14th Court of Appeals called EuroCap. And EuroCap literally says that if you ask for business, that is not a solicitation. Okay? Well, if that's not a solicitation, I don't know what is. But it's out there. You're also having problems now with the new technology of LinkedIn and Facebook, because it used to be, until even the EuroCap case, is that if I approached a customer after I left, that was a solicitation. If I took them out to dinner, played golf with them, said, hey, I want your business, that was a solicitation. EuroCap doesn't say that is. LinkedIn and Facebook, now you just post my new job, everybody knows, all my customers know, and they can follow the former employee, okay? So what you want to do is, your business interest is to stop the employee from stealing the customer. So say it, you will not accept business from my customer, okay? That cuts all that out, and it's an easily enforceable provision. The next one is, don't have overbroad restrictions. And the reason being is, The test for non-compete is it reasonable as to time, scope, and geographic area? Okay. If you have an unreasonable non-compete that everyone knew is overbroad and you try to enforce it, attorney's fees can go against the company. Okay. That counterclaim you'll get almost in every case. Okay. There are cases, and there's a Sentinel case out of the 14th Court of Appeals, that awarded $750,000 to the employee because they tried to enforce a non-compete. Now, that's actually the music that the court hears when I walk in, Okay. I'm just telling you, you know, just saying. What I'm about to talk to you now about are provisions that literally have helped me in a courtroom. And typically what I do is, and I've done, like as you said, I do a bunch of this, and I'm a non-compete nerd, which I'm not sure what that says, but I just really love non-compete law, is that when I have a good argument against me, I'm like, wow, I didn't think about that. I write that down in my book. Same thing with provisions. The first one is can't plan to compete while employed. The reason that's important is that there's always a duty of loyalty, okay? So you don't even have to have that as a provision. But if you do, then it turns a common law duty to a contractual duty, which if you're going to get a TRO, you're going to win that breach of duty argument, and they have to pay your attorney's fees. And companies, you know, there's nothing companies like more than having other people pay their attorney's fees. And so that's a general provision that could be put in that is very advantageous. The second one is the no collection of pieces of information. What a lot of people do is they'll say, oh, well, this is out in the public, okay? Well, if you prevent people from collecting information out in the public and combine it, that is a restriction that is not under common law, but it can be a contractual restriction, which really helps in the oil and gas field. It really does. And then the third one is no leaving, don't just leave the non-solicitation provision, have a can't accept business, because that's what you're trying to stop. You're trying to stop them from taking your business. The last four are an exit interview requirement. Again, most people don't have that as a contractual requirement. And the reason you want that in there is so one, if they don't do it because they're going to go compete against you, it's another breach of contract. Second of all, if they do come, okay, then you have the ability to tell them of their obligations of, you know, don't steal trade secrets, don't call on my customers, blah, 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 blah. Okay. So if they don't show up, that's good for us. If they do show up, that's good for us. And then also, I usually have an acknowledgement form that I have them either sign or not sign that says they acknowledge that you have the trade secrets and they won't use them. Again, if they walk out, that's good for us because, hey, judge, we have to have a TRO because they won't agree to not use our trade secrets. If they do sign it, that's good for us because when they breach that, that's another time where they gave their word, judge, you can't trust them because they broke it. Another thing is an injunction extension during breach provision. Basically, what that means is if you have a 2-year non-compete, if you have a provision that says the injunction will go beyond that 2 years or they'll extend the 2-year period as long as they're in breach, that's important because some judges will grant that, some judges won't, but if it's not in there, you have no chance of granting that. And then again, as I said before, the effective date. Again, one of the most important things you can have is have an effective date as compared to a signature date for the enforceability.
Thank you for listening to Energy Law Roundup. If you would like additional information about anything from today's episode, you can contact Tom at 210-446-6999 or by email at tom@charlone.net. New episodes of this podcast are available every week on the web at www.energylawroundup.com. Your one-stop source for breaking news and developments in energy law.